with it. It works. I mean, it doesn't have the bells and whistles, but it saves you the cost of an adapter or a brand new flash. Although I think flashes have gone down in price versus Sears. Of course, you know, the main players are still a bit overpriced because they're a certain brand, but there's a bunch of Chinese companies that sell surprisingly very good quality flash devices that are automated and that have different cord interfaces that operate with a whole bunch of different cameras.
Well, you know, a long time ago, I did my thesis for a graduate program, photography and video media, and I took a manual camera. It was a Hasselblad with a 75-millimeter lens, and I used a Nikon flash with a PC and got a great results with it, or at least I was pleased with it.
Okay, great. Hasselblad has always been a real high-quality camera. Recently, I think they were sold off to DJI, and they recently came out with a new digital version. I think it's, you know, those things don't go for cheap, so I think it costs something like $7,000. And but they're, you know, very nice, very high quality cameras, large format type of cameras, bigger than a 35-millimeter frame. But, yeah, they're very nice. They're kind of bulky. You know, they weigh a little bit more than most, 35-millimeter pseudo-format cameras. But some people love them, and, a lot of photographers really like them. There's one guy who got kind of famous. He took a picture of the people working in the White House. He's famous for shooting very close-up images, and you could see every pore in some of these people's faces that he took a picture of.
Sounds scary to me, but I think it's better to have a wide-angle lens get up close than to have a telephoto lens and stay far away. Well, you know, this Hasselblad that I used, 500C, and I used the Portra 400 120 film. It's a negative, color negative film.
Okay. I actually played a little bit with, I think 120 film was the first film I played with. It's My father, should rest in peace, had a twin lens reflex camera that was 120 film, and so he had the negatives, and I did contact prints, so which look a lot better than 35 millimeter contact prints. But that was very early in my hobby, and I had yet to buy an enlarger, so I played around with 120 films for a year or two or three.
QSL. Maybe 5 years ago, there was an exhibit of a photographer, his name, Gary Winogrand, and they had much of his work, and then a lot of his unknown work were the enlargement from the contact sheet.
Okay. Like I said, it's a lot easier on the eyes than 35 millimeter contact sheets. But yeah, I mean, if you got an enlarger, it's no real problem. But at the beginning, when I started out, I just bought some trays and I bought some chemistry from a local photo shop in Brooklyn, and I made contact prints that were reasonably sized, so that you could give it to people to put in their wallets if they were so inclined. Whereas you can't really do that with 35 millimeters. It's just too small. It gets lost.
The technology that they use for that exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you know, quite advanced. I guess, you know, they photoshopped them, and if there was any dust, I had to take the dust out and to enlarge it. I don't think it was AI back then, although you can scale up the resolution of pictures with artificial intelligence.
Probably were a lot of relatively simple methods of scaling up contact prints. You know, you could kind of take a picture again and then scale it up and print it digitally. Probably that would make all the artistic people cringe. But I'm sure there's all kinds of workarounds during the early days because people manipulated images for 100 years before computers and before Photoshop ever existed.
Well, you know, you can take video at 1080p. 1080p, you can make it, scale it up to 4K with artificial intelligence incorporated in the video editing program.
Well, I mean, I think we use artificial intelligence as a term too much. There have been upscaling algorithms that don't really qualify as artificial intelligence that have been in television sets for at least the last 10, 12 years. I mean, when 4K first came on, most of the source material was 2K, so, you know, they just used upscaling, algorithms. But again, it wouldn't qualify as artificial intelligence. It didn't then, I wouldn't say now. But, you know, it's grown more sophisticated, and eventually they'll throw AI at everything, including cornflakes. But upscale, again, is something that's been around that predates AI.
Yeah, perhaps it's just a product that people try to sell you, you know, to say we can do it with this quality, with this resolution. You know, you probably couldn't tell the difference. Maybe it's sharper when you scale it up.
Yeah. I mean, you could make it too sharp. Again, if you could set it to 11. There's a lot of new stuff that's supposedly AI-oriented. It uses different models. I have software where you can run an old video and it'll kind of examine it and make suggestions of which model would work best, you know, if it needs to have noise reduced or progressive alternating scans, intermittent scans changed into progressive scans. And they do very nice stuff. I mean, if you kind of go a little too crazy, you will generate artifacts that, if you have a good eye, will kind of disrupt the watching. But it's sort of surprising the quality of upscaled video that computers can crank out. They do it quite, at least I can't, in real time. But, you know, if you give them a couple hours, it's amazing what they can do to an old video source that a person has.
To tell me the source, the quality of the original video has a lot to do with the quality that you get after you scale it up.
Well, I mean, in practical terms, it's easier to scale up a good quality video than a bad quality video. And the more, the worse the initial quality is, the more you risk creating artifacts that kind of ruin the effect. But, you know, again, surprisingly, I've had kind of a mediocre video that looks very decent for this age instead of the VHS tape source that it began in.
QSL. And did we ever talk about Sony Vega Trinitron TV 24 inches?
I don't remember one way or the other. By the way, I don't know if you heard or anyone else cares, Apparently, Sony has kind of signed a little agreement to sell, I think, 51% of their video electronics division to TCL out of China.
USL, do you think that Sony got a lot of parts from China?
Well, yeah, I don't think they make a lot of their own parts. These days, Sony's promotion is in their processor technology, that they're able to improve the manipulation of the video signal. So, you know, they make a bunch of chips, but as far as the display itself is, I think right now Korean, but I guess eventually it'll shift to China when TCL kind of starts to run it. So, yeah, gone are the days that Sony was kind of in-house. There's a lot of components that they simply buy from either Korea or China these days.
So let's say you have an old TV, 1994, 24 inches, flat screen, but it's a CRT. So it's a deep TV, you know. And it has two speakers in the front and two speakers in the back. The audio is pretty good. What if you want to take digital broadcast and put it into that TV?
Well, it would sort of depend upon what would happen. Yeah, I mean, you'd have to kind of downscale it because Your Sony is most likely an NTSC standard. It's not the ATSC 1 or ATSC 3 that's digital. So you're gonna, what happens when you try and cram a composite video of a high resolution into an NTSC a television set? Unless you have a sophisticated adapter device, it would probably look like a mess.
Well, you start with the antenna. You have an antenna, you have a preamplifier, you connect it to a digital to analog converter, and digital to analog converter, so you're taking the broadcast signal kind of port that allows for the signal to connect, and then not so good.
Yeah, I mean, like I said before, the problem is at the very best, you're taking a 1080 digital signal and converting it to, I guess, a 1080 analog somehow. And you're trying to feed it into a device that's expecting 480 lines. So, you know, unless you have something really sophisticated that kind of transcodes it, where, you know, it somehow takes the 1080 in and spits it out as an NTSC low-resolution signal, you're going to get a lot of distortion. It's not going to be a viable signal as far as I can see.
Digital to analog converter, it has a remote control. Remote control, you press menu, then you press, format, I don't know what it was called, and then you can select the resolution of a picture. But I realized that if I use 1080p, you know, that it'll somehow automatically scale down to the TV.
Okay, so it has a built-in downscaler. That's a very useful talent. I doubt if you'd kind of find anything capable of doing that these days. You know, everyone's looking to upscale, not downscale.
Well, I guess, you know, having this TV in a digital-to-analog converter, the advantage is, you know, if the internet is down, I can still watch TV, get news, whatever.
Well, you, to a degree, you could still do that, you know, with a more modern TV set. You know, I mean, you could use a hotspot off of your cell phone if you have that service available to you, and you know, you could do open over the air antennas and get signals that way too. So you know, there's other options out there. But if you're happy with the 480 lines interlaced, then so be it. You know, most people I don't think like to kind of go back to 480. I don't mind 1080. You know, I never really upgraded to the 4K. But you know, maybe someday I will if I need to get a new TV for some reason. But, you know, it's what you're used to and what you're happy with. Are you still out there, David? I don't hear you. Okay, something must have happened to David's radio. I hope he fixes it quickly. Anyway, it's been loads of fun, guys. We must do this again real soon. I'll be back after the SpaceNet report to say nighty-night and tuck you in. But right now, it's a good time for Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet report.
Okay, AC2GS, WS2N, SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, yeah, I got a 1080p. And what if that ever quits, I'm going to go with the OLED. I mean, they're big money. But prices are creeping down little by little. So maybe when I get to a decent price, I would get one of them. I've seen them in the stores. I think they're the best right now. But, yeah. Okay, yeah, I have a few topics we can go through here. Okay, very good. You remember about 2.5, almost, I guess around 2.5, 3 months ago, New Glenn rocket flying through the atmosphere and the booster and landed on a barge. It was the first for, what was the name of the company? Blue Origin. Blue Origin has the New Glenn rocket. And they have this, you know, 40-story tall booster that, you know, that this whole rocket that they launched. And then the booster came back and landed on this barge, dead center. I mean, perfect landing. I know when SpaceX tried to do that, it took them many, many tries, you know, half a dozen flights, you know, just to crash into the water, crash onto the ship, and all kinds of problems. This was their second launch, and the first launch, they didn't have enough to get back to the drone ship. The payload made it to orbit. That was a success. Again, that's unusual for first rockets to do that. And Blue Origin had this massive booster land and returned to be refurbished, which was very little work because they're using LNG, liquid natural gas, extremely clean, no carbon. If you see a Falcon 9 come back, it's all dirty looking and all. This thing came back, it looked like it was spotless. And because the Falcon 9 uses refined kerosene for fuel, RP-1 they call it. But not Blue Origin. So now they're already ready to send it back up into space. You know, it's got 7 engines, BE-4 engines, each one producing over 550,000 pounds of thrust. Collectively, comes out to around almost 4 million pounds of thrust. And then, again, this will come back and land on the drone ship, and the second stage will continue to orbit, and that will have two BE-3 engines. That's liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. Now that one's not reusable, but that will put the payload into orbit. This time the payload is going to be, I think, 34. Wait a minute. Anyway, they have a company, AST, is putting satellites into a low Earth orbit. They got a whole bunch of them on board. But to me, the main story is this rocket, because this rocket is a direct competitor to Elon Musk. And it's run by Jeff Bezos. And we'll see how this thing works out. They have a bigger rocket plan now, bigger than this one. This one stood almost as high as the Saturn V rocket that took people to the moon. The next one, which should be ready in a couple of years, is taller than the Saturn V rocket. But it will use the same engines. Instead of 7, it will have 9. The second stage will have even more rockets on board that. So they're really coming along, which is good, because they are a major provider for NASA to put crews onto the moon. Not only will they put crews on the moon, they plan on delivering cargo up to 6,000 pounds every time they launch a vehicle to the moon. And that's the equivalent of, like, maybe three Toyotas, you know. I think of it like that. You know, roughly 6,000 pounds every time they land, which means that they'll be resupplying crews on the moon with science equipment, food, clothes, power, you know. And they're really going to need that thing. And that's called the Mark II. It's called Blue Moon Mark II. Correction, Mark I. Mark II is the crew version. Anyway, they're very similar. The only difference is the size of the crew vehicle is going to be about twice the height. But the Mark I vehicle will be still about twice the size of the LEM that went to the moon. Landed successfully six different times. This thing's got to be about that, about the, twice that. But the crew version eventually will be even bigger than this one. And they've been developing this for quite a few years, and the pretty much finished version of it just was shipped from where it was being made in Florida. They're shipping it to Houston, and they're going to send it there for testing at test facilities. And then if that works out okay, they'll eventually bring it back to Florida and get ready to send that up. And, they plan on doing that by the end of this year. And they need to confirm that they could launch a rocket with their own, their own rocket with their own massive payload, this MK-1 cargo vehicle, and actually land it on on the moon at the South Pole. And, you know, if that all works out, they'll be sending an actual cargo to the moon very shortly. And eventually, I think even before Elon Musk gets ready with his Starship, this thing will be ready. They're competing. NASA gave Blue Origin a contract to land people on the moon with the Blue Moon MK2 version of this thing, where Elon Musk is going to be landing Starship on the moon. And as you know, if you follow the space program, Starship is pretty much in trouble right now. They're way behind schedule. You know, with the 10 or 11,000 employees, you know, they might pull it off. They might be able to get back on track. They haven't even put their vehicle into orbit yet. They're a Starship where New Glenn first shot 3 months ago. Was their second flight, and then almost a year before that was their first flight. So this will be the third flight of the New Glenn vehicle, where Starship has flown, I think, what, they're up to the 12th one now. And even this next one, which will probably go up in, you know, probably a couple of months, is still not scheduled to go to orbit. They have a long way to go. They have to be able to get their Starship to orbit. It's got to be able to de-orbit and come back to Earth. It's got to be able to be caught with these gigantic arms that are at the launch complex. They eventually have to send the tanker up into Earth orbit and refuel that with many, many flights. And then when that's completely fueled, then they would set Starship lunar version up, would dock with the tanker, would fuel up in Earth orbit, and then it would fly off to the moon. So it sounds like it's a long way off to me, unless things really get moving. But with Blue Origin, different. They're moving at a steady, very steady pace. Looking forward to their launch from the Launch Complex 36. They've completely rebuilt that launch complex. And this will be the third one from that launch complex. Would anybody like to make any comments or questions? WS2M.
F2ZZ.
Go right ahead. And it's WS2N.
And I agree with you about Elon Musk and Starship, which even hasn't achieved a single orbit. So it's pretty concerning. And the other thing I'm more concerned about is the SLS that's positioned at the Cape. And I'm reading stories about the heat shield, and I thought you might want to look at that for a second.
Yeah, they rolled out Artemis 2, Sabbath Launch Complex 39B right now. Made that 4-mile trek from the vehicle assembly building last week. Took them roughly around 12 hours to do that. Only goes at a couple of miles per hour on the lunar transporter, this big crawler. And they have two of those crawlers. And then they're the same ones that brought the Apollo spacecraft out to the launch complex when they launched. The same ones that brought out the 135 different shuttle men that went up. So, sitting out at the launch complex now. When Artemis 1 went up, that was unmanned. They brought it out to the launch complex, same one. And when they ran through a wet rehearsal, they call it a wet rehearsal, that's when they fill up the tanks with 750,000 gallons worth of fuel and liquid oxygen, make sure everything holds together, and they duplicate a launch. They go all the way down to, like 30 seconds or so before they would normally launch, and then computers shut everything off. And if everything's fine, then they'll eventually put a crew on board and do the same thing, except the only difference is they'll launch. So, hopefully that wet dress rehearsal goes well. Don't know when they're going to be doing that, probably soon, because they have a planned launch of this crew of four to go around the moon on February 6th. Unless there's a weather delay, which is happens all the time. If they have a mechanical problem like they did with Artemis 1, where they couldn't get a good tight seal on the quick disconnect, these are massive connections that, I think there were like 17-inch diameter pipes or something that they used to the vehicles. If those connections aren't tight, the same kind of problem would occur where it would bring the whole vehicle back to vehicle assembly building, and who knows how long it would take. When they did that with Artemis 1, it would take, a month or two before they'd be ready to launch again. They did that to try to correct the helium, I think they had hydrogen and helium leaks at the time. So I'm assuming they probably have that all figured out on this flight. And only time will tell. Anyway, back to you, WS2M. Okay, all quiet. Very good. Sometimes your signal breaks up. I think Roy told you that as well. You did good, but if you made another transmission there, we didn't hear you. One other thing I wanted to bring up is this launch of, actually it was another Blue Origin event. They put another six people into orbit. They launched six people on another New Shepard vehicle. They call it NS-38 because they've launched New Shepard a total of 38 times. That's collectively between unmanned launches and crew launches. This is the one that launched from West Texas. Goes on suborbital flights, goes up to well over 300,000 feet above the Earth, which is, they like to get above 62 miles, which is the common line, anything above 62 miles, or 100 kilometers, that's where they really get it from, 100 kilometers up, but mile-wise, it's 62. So once they get above that, then they coast for 3 or 4 minutes of weightlessness, and then they come back. And this one was a crew vehicle of six more people that went up, which I found amazing. I mean, there was no news reports. I didn't even see it on the internet that this thing was going up. Usually I do, because they have made so many flights. They've sent a total amount of people, 90 people since they started launching people on New Shepard on these orbital 15-minute flights. So that's pretty amazing since they started doing this about 5 years ago, a little less than 5 years ago. They only launch one engine. It's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine, producing around 160,000 pounds of thrust. So that's all they need to for that kind of a flight. And the engine is so reliable. From the beginning, they knew they were going to use this engine on the second stage of the New Glenn rocket. That's the big one, the one with almost 4 million pounds of thrust for the first stage. Well, the second stage has the same rocket engine that pushes people up on these suborbital flights. And that's called the BE-3 engine, and that's liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And they put two of those engines on the second stage, which is really amazing. And on the next New Glenn rocket, the bigger one that will eventually come out, it kind of looks like the same rocket. It's taller. The diameter is not any different, but it's definitely taller. And that'll have the nine engines on the first stage. There'll be seven engines. And on the second stage, instead of the two BE-3 engines, the same ones that launched the crew of six up a couple of days ago, instead of two, they'll have four on that one. So you'll be able to put a tremendous amount of payload into either low Earth orbit or geosynchronous orbit or right into the moon, Mars or beyond. So, they had six people. This guy, Tim Drexler, he was the pilot he's a pilot on his own right, but he's the CEO of an Atfall company. And they had a woman, Linda Edwards. She went up. Some kind of a genealogist or obstetrician. She's retired. I don't know where she got the money. I think these flights cost like $300,000 or something to go up on a Blue Origin rocket. You had this Alan Fernandez. He's a real estate developer. Big money, some kind of a scuba instructor. That's what it takes to go up. Alberto Gutierrez, I think it is. He's an entrepreneur involved with travel. And then you have Laura Stiles. She actually works for Blue Origin. What happened is one of the six got sick before they were going to go up. So they, it's like backups, the fellow that backed out, whatever sickness he has, he already told Blue Origin, the next flight I'm on or the next one, that you have an opening for. So, they will get a chance to go to suborbital space. But they just replaced this Laura style. New Shepard launched the operations. I believe she went up before. I'm familiar with that name. But, that's interesting. Any comments?
Been pretty comprehensive, Paul, but you didn't answer my question about the SI shield.
I didn't hear the heat shield part. See, you pop in and out once in a while. Okay, you wanted to know about the heat shield. Yeah, they have a heat shield that some astronauts, from the past are worried about. They are going to use it anyway. The first mission that they sent Artemis 1 all the way around the moon and back without a crew came back. they had plans of having the vehicle land in the Pacific Ocean, which it did successfully. So, you know, it comes back from around the moon. Any time it goes out to the moon and back, it's traveling at 25,000 miles per hour when it enters the atmosphere and really heats up. The guys, I mentioned it earlier, that's when you get up to these 5,000-degree temperatures. If you're in Earth orbit at 17,500 miles an hour, you go around, you get around 3,000 degrees on your heat shield. So they need to have a better one. Apollo had an ablative heat shield, and they used this Abacote stuff on that, and it worked out okay. So they figured, well, use the same stuff, but they decided to do it a little different. On Apollo, they had like the whole bottom, which was I think around 12 and a half or 13 feet in diameter. This thing is 16 and a half feet in diameter. So they thought, let's go with this little block formation, a bunch of blocks made of the same stuff, and we'll put this together. And they said, well, this is a good idea. And then they, again, you know, coated it with the same stuff. But for some reason, they found out later why, but when it came back, it was little chips had broken apart. You know, when you have an ablative heat shield, it's supposed to come off smoothly, and, you know, it looks pretty good when you look at it. This thing had a bunch of pieces missing. You know, through the whole bottom of the heat shield. So they looked into it, and they realized, okay, we have a problem. It's getting up to high heat very fast, and there's like little, let's call them pockets within these blocks, and you know, when anytime you have gas and heating very quick, the gas is going to expand, and those expansion of those gas bubbles, you know, created this the breakup of a lot of these blocks that are on the bottom of the heat shield. So it looked all scarred, looking dark, chunks missing. So they came up with a cure. They already had the next heat shield completed for this mission, for Artemis 2. For Artemis 3, they don't have it completed, so there's a plan to do something different with Artemis 3. With Artemis 2, it was already done, and it would have been cost-effective to take this all apart and try to redo it. I mean, it wasn't doable. Mechanically, I guess they could have done it, but financially, it would have cost a fortune, and also it would have delayed this particular mission. Who knows how long. So they said, well, we have a cure. When we come back from the moon, what we'll do is, well, instead of entering the atmosphere, more or less like a ballistic shot right down into the Pacific Ocean. You know, they come through the atmosphere, the heat shield slows them down, the parachutes open up, they land in the Pacific Ocean. Instead of doing that, they'll do this skip reentry, which actually they've before with the Apollo missions. What that is they'll come in. Instead of an angle like 60 degrees or something coming through the atmosphere, they're going to come through like at 30 degrees. This way, they'll hit the atmosphere and it'll slow them down. The heat shield will get hot, but not that hot because what's going to happen is they're going to rise up. you know, the shape of the vehicle, that they have a way of creating lift. So if they come out in a certain way and then they rotate that vehicle, you know, to a, you know, a certain point, it will actually start to rise back up and they will leave the atmosphere a little bit and travel, you know, further, you know, not going into orbit, but further downrange. And then they'll dip into the atmosphere again and start reheating the heat shield. And what will happen is you're spreading the heat out over a amount of time, and each time you're going up into the cooler, you know, space, you know, you're cooling these blocks or the heat shield off on a regular basis. So, you know, by doing this, they feel that they'll have no problem. So last time the heat shield came through ballistically, and this one is going to be like a stone skipping on a lake when you throw it, you know. Anyway, back to you, Dave.
Thank you again.
that I see, Dave. Okay, Brian, very good. Yeah. I'm the only one that's getting tired. Yeah, very good. I just want to mention that NASA did select over 30 different people and organizations to monitor this flight, this SLS flight to the moon, and of those 34 people are actual ham radio operators, amateur radio operators. So that they have a, you know, we have a list of people that are involved, and from the Canadian Space Agency are involved, and, you know, different groups from the United Kingdom and so on and so forth. And I went down the list looking at, you know, who's involved. And one guy's name stood out, Scott Tilley. And I said, I know that guy. He's been in the news before. He's the guy that figured out there was a satellite that was in solar orbit that NASA lost, like, you know, 50 years ago, and one day it started to come back, and it was some kind of a signal that he was able to pick up from this thing, this ham. He comes out of Canada. They wrote him up for discovery thing, you know. NASA didn't know what it was, you know, they pick it up on a radar, but this guy actually figured out what satellite it was. It was an old, I think, an old booster or something, one of the earlier flights. But anyway, he's involved, so he'll be helping track this mission. And he, you know, his call letter is VE7 TIL from Canada. I think he's in Western Canada, probably Vancouver or something. Maybe British Columbia. But very active. Really into all the satellite stuff. And there's a whole list of, like I said, 30-some-odd people or organizations that will be helping monitor the flight to and from the moon. Now you say, well, why do they need this? You know, they have the Deep Space Network. Deep Space Network is around the globe. At 120 degrees apart, you have antennas in Goldstone, California. You have them in Madrid, Spain, and you have them in Canberra down in Australia. Massive, you know, couple hundred diameter antennas, a series of, you know, maybe three or four of these antennas in each location. And all of them are always busy. There's like at least like 20 or more ongoing
time complete.
That these things are always working and talking to, and they, you know, they can't, you can't be everywhere at one time. So they're looking for in the future other means of communicating with people to and from the moon and eventually on the moon. And once we have a base on the moon or the Gateway space station going around the moon, I'm hoping that AMSAT you know, gets involved with, you know, having a station on either on the moon or on the space station, similar to what we have on International Space Station, and what we used to have on a shuttle mission called SARAX, where you could make contact with astronauts on board the space station, and eventually the moon. Now that would be the ultimate QSL DX card. Any last comments before I turn it over to Roy? We're getting to the witching hour. Said something, but in and out. Okay, anyway, 73 guys, we'll be back on the air tomorrow for the Club InfoNet, which comes on at 8:30 on these repeaters, followed by George with Swap and Shop, And then that's always followed by Radio Newsline. Return to Roy, AC2GSWS2N. Put a space net report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
Thanks, Bo.
Very good.
Thank
73,
you.
Brian.
Yeah, yeah, it's AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do on the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it, and I also appreciate all of you people that participated tonight. I hope you'll join us next Sunday at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. But try and stay ice-free, warm and dry, and I hope the snow melts real soon. I'm not a big fan of snowmen anymore. Kind of outgrew that phase a few decades ago. Anyway, stay safe, be well, as per always. Let me leave you with the words of a few wise men, our own Dick, K2RIW. He would often end his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other, and that's always good advice. And I never miss a chance to quote good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open to new ideas, but not so wide open that your brain falls out, because you're going to need it one of these days. Anyway, stay safe, be well, and please, if you can, join us next Sunday at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. This is AC2GS, and I will be clear after I say Slava Ukraini. Yes, Brian, you're very, very noisy, unfortunately.
What is that, noise?
I can't make out what you're saying, unfortunately.
Really? I don't know what's going on. I'll check it.
Your last transmission was flawless, so I don't know what's going on.
All right, no problem. Have a good week.
You too, Brian.